What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged. And
the U.S. received from an intelligence partner?
I'm not going to be the one to confirm that sort of information that could jeopardize our security.
President Donald Trump's national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, speaking earlier today, McMaster addressed reports that Trump has shared classified ISIS data with Russian officials when they were in the Oval Office last week. He used that phrase, wholly appropriate, at least five times during that press briefing. Trump also tweeted he had an absolute right to share the data. But the move has drawn criticism from both Democrats and some Republicans and has fueled calls for an independent investigation into Trump's Russia ties. Joining us to break down all the information so far is Aaron Blake, reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And also joining us, David A. Graham, staff writer for The Atlantic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Aaron, let's begin with you. Your paper, The Washington Post, broke this story, but McMaster said it is false. Here's a clip from today's briefing.
You said that the Washington Post story, which came out late yesterday afternoon, was false. Do you stick by that assertion? Do you think that every element of that story is false? And do you have anything to correct in terms of what you said at the podium yesterday afternoon?
No, I stand by my statement that I made yesterday. What I'm saying is really the premise of that article is false, that in any way the president had a conversation that was inappropriate or that resulted in any kind of lapse in national security.
Okay, so Aaron, what is the paper saying in response to that response?
Well, I don't know exactly what the response is at this point, but I know last night in the face of McMaster's initial denial, our response is that we simply stand by everything in the story. I think that if you look closely at what General McMaster said today, he kind of tempered his comments from yesterday a little bit. Instead of saying the story was false, he said he disagrees with the premise of the story, that basically this is information that could compromise national security in some way or compromise an alliance. So I think it's important to note here that the White House isn't talking so much about Trump not sharing classified information. They're now talking about whether this was basically within his legal rights to do so. And so I think that's a completely different conversation for them to be having than the one that they previewed yesterday.
And Trump himself tweeted that he did share this information.
Yeah, I mean, it was tacitly acknowledged in the tweet. He didn't say it so flatly, but he invoked his presidential authority, which is something that you basically only need to do if you're talking about classified information.
David, there are reports now that the intelligence came from Israel. So what does that mean for our relationship with that country?
It's very interesting, particularly because Trump is going to visit Israel next week. You know, back in January, there were reports in the Israeli press that some people in the Israeli intelligence community were wary of sharing information with the American administration, the incoming administration, because they were specifically concerned he was too close to Russia and anything they told the U.S. might end up with Russia and then moving on to Iran. And so here we have a situation where reportedly intelligence from Israel has made it as far as Russia via the U.S. And that's in the context of disputes as well about the location of the American embassy in Israel, and more recently about where the Western Wall is located, what country has control over it.
Right. So flesh that out a little bit. That was a comment that McMaster made today that has drawn some criticism, right?
About the wall?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very strange dispute. You know, the Trump administration has said it will be the best friend Israel has ever had and has generally taken the side of Benjamin Netanyahu. But in this question over Trump visiting the Western Wall, which he said he wants to do, U.S. diplomats apparently in Israel said to the prime minister's office, he doesn't want Netanyahu there. And besides, it's the West Bank. It's not controlled by you. And the Israeli government is protesting that and saying, in fact, it is Israeli territory. That's disputed, but it'd be unusual for the Trump administration to pick this fight at this moment.
Okay, so Aaron, let's get back to this information that was shared with the Russians in the Oval Office. It reportedly had to do with ISIS plots to use laptops as bombs on planes, and we have heard about this before. Why shouldn't Donald Trump have talked to the Russians about this? What codes of confidentiality did he break?
Sure. Well, it's not illegal for the president to share this kind of information. Broadly speaking, the president has the power to declassify things that he feels he needs to discuss with certain parties, and so he was probably within his legal rights to do this. I think the two complicating factors here are, one, the people he was talking to, which are people from Russia, an adversarial foreign power, by the way, which has different goals in the Syrian civil war, where the Islamic State's obviously a major player. So tipping them off to things about the Islamic State would be troubling, potentially. The other part of this is that it could jeopardize a very apparently fruitful intelligence gathering relationship that the U.S. government has in the Middle East. And that intelligence gathering arrangement is a very secretive one, one that's not even known to many allies, according to our reporting. And so to the extent that something that was very, very secretive is now potentially being discovered by an adversarial foreign power, I think that's where it starts to become a more problematic scenario.
And David, getting back to the Israel question in regards to what Aaron just said. So one of Israel's major adversaries is Iran, which has a big stake in what's happening in Syria and has allied itself with Russia. So how would this complicate Israel's position there in the Middle East, should Israel have indeed been the source of this intel?
It's a little bit tough to tell because, we don't know what specifically intelligence that was passed along was. The Washington Post rejected that on the request of the administration. And so, we don't know specifically what the questions are. It points to this oddness where the U.S. is allied with Israel. It is making some overtures to Russia. They're both, Russia and the U.S. are rivals for power and rivals for sort of being the major broker in Syria. But they're kind of on different sides because of Russia's ties to Iran. So it's very complicated, and we don't know really, I think, at this point, what the sources or methods that would be disclosed would be.
Mm-hmm. What has been the reaction from Moscow to all this?
Moscow has been fairly tight-lipped about it. They didn't, last night their immediate reaction was not to confirm or deny, and I think they're generally staying out of the matter so far.
Right. And then what would it mean in terms of our relationship with other allies and other foreign countries?
Well, that's what a lot of intelligence experts and veterans have been saying, is that there's a real danger that this just hurts U.S. credibility. If the U.S. is known to share these things like this without permission and seemingly off the cuff, allies are going to be reluctant to share information with the U.S. to pass things along. It strains alliances and it strains U.S. national security if we can't obtain the same kind of partner information we're used to getting.
And does this complicate the president's trip later this week?
It absolutely should. I mean, one thing we know is the president seems to repeatedly give a lot away to foreign leaders in conversations. He's got these trips coming up. There's a danger of that. He has a potentially fraught trip to Israel because of if Israel was, in fact, the source of this intelligence. His trip to Saudi Arabia is going to be complicated because of the comments he's made about Islam in the past and simply because of relations with Iran and all the reasons that make Saudi Arabia a complicated ally for the U.S. And then from there, he goes on to the Vatican City, and then on to a NATO conference. So really every stop could be very complicated for him.
And Aaron, your paper reported that people within the intelligence community had called for this portion of Trump's conversation to be stricken from internal memos and for the full transcript only to be shared with a few people. What is the latest on that?
Well, I think that just speaks to the sensitive nature of what was discussed here. The H.R. McMaster said at the briefing today that this was a wholly appropriate thing for the president to share, but his definition of wholly appropriate seemed to be whatever the president feels is important to disclose in a given meeting. I mean, he was basically pointing to the legal case for what a president is allowed to disclose in these settings. So, I think the White House is kind of playing a little bit of a word game here with what is legal, what is appropriate, and what is advantageous. The real question here is how this impacts our alliances with allies, and I imagine that this is going to be something that we're going to hear about plenty going forward. We actually heard today from the Associated Press that one European ally, who I think was anonymous, said that this gave them pause about sharing intelligence with the United States government, knowing that perhaps their identities won't be as closely safeguarded as this one was.
Right. And David, this is an example of how Donald Trump kind of modifies his behavior when he's on one-on-one with foreign leaders, that he kind of gets more casual, talks more off the cuff, is friendlier.
Yeah, he seems to repeatedly do this. He met with Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, and came out of that meeting suddenly saying that China was not a currency manipulator and saying really it didn't have the power of North Korea, he had said before. He came out of this meeting apparently having passed information to the Russians. He threatened to pull out of NAFTA, and then after quick phone conversations with the Canadian and Mexican leaders, changed his mind. And so it does seem that for all the bluster he displays publicly, in one-on-one conversations, he tends to be rather conciliatory.
What's happening on Capitol Hill? What's the reaction, especially on the part of Republicans, Aaron? Just want to note that we have reached out to many Republican lawmakers who have not been available to come on today. I'm wondering if they're saying anything.
Well, I think that's telling that they're not willing to come on your show here. I think most of them are trying to stay away from this. It's continuing a posture that we saw last week in the aftermath of the firing of FBI Director James Comey. I think they saw this as a thing that they didn't want to weigh in on if they didn't have to. It was a very difficult thing to defend, and so most of them chose to stay quiet about it. In this case, we've seen certainly some very critical comments, especially from John McCain, who has been critical of the president before. Also from Bob Corker, who's a senator from Tennessee, who's somewhat of a moderate, somewhat of an establishment figure, but also kind of has a reputation as a real one of the more honest senators about these matters. But then we have Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who said basically that he wishes the president would allow them to spend time on other things, that these are distractions, but also kind of, you know, to some degree took the White House's line on excusing this as something that the president is capable of doing and maybe doubting the reports to some degree here. So I'm not sure this changes a whole lot for Capitol Hill, apart from maybe continuing to test their patience with some real unforced errors coming from the White House.
Yeah, and anyone taking up the call from the White House that the leaks should be investigated, that's the real problem?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is the White House's counterargument whenever something comes out that results from these leaks. And I think it's a valid argument to make that leaks can be damaging to a government. But you also have to point out the fact that the reason these leaks are happening is generally because people see something happening behind the scenes that they don't think is good. A lot of these people are people who are working for the president of their own volition, and they may see something that they think is worth bringing to the public's attention. They're exasperated by something or another. And so that's where the leaks come from, and I think that, you know, it's okay to focus on whether there should be leaks and whether those things should be investigated, but not at the expense of very valid issues that were raised in the Post report last night.
All right, we'll end it there. Aaron Blake, Washington Post reporter, David A. Graham, staff writer for The Atlantic. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, joining us now is LA Mayor Eric Garcetti. He's in Washington, where he spoke this morning before the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress. Other Democratic leaders are there, too. Senator Kamala Harris, New Jersey's Cory Booker, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is seen as an early vetting forum for possible presidential candidates. Hello, Mayor.
How are you?
Can you give us your thoughts on the news of the day, and that is the story of President Trump divulging classified information to the Russians? What do you think needs to happen now?
Well, you know, I've served as an intelligence officer in the United States Navy for nearly a decade. I know that the president does have the power to declassify almost anything. But our alliances, and I specialize in the area of human intelligence, which is, you know, people and the sources that can be divulged can endanger people's lives and endanger our long-term relationships of whether people will share with us, because they have to depend on our discretion. So just because you can do something doesn't make it right to do it. And it's very troubling, not just as an American, but as somebody who's been, you know, an intelligence professional, if that indeed did happen, as I think the president has confirmed. I think that we need to make sure that we stand for something in America, that we don't just say, oh, today it could be this, tomorrow it could be that, because if we stand for nothing, we don't stand for anything. And that's the strength of America, is not just our wealth, not just our military, not just our hardware, but the soft power we have of people saying, you can trust Americans, Americans stand for something bigger and better. And if we lose that, I'm really worried it will take years to reestablish that, because it will seem like Americans are just about power politics and nothing else.
Do you believe he has endangered national security?
I think that divulging the sources, the individuals, can endanger those people's lives first and foremost, which worries me. And yes, these things can have an effect on whether allies will in the future share information with us, and we depend on that. We cannot by ourselves, militarily or in terms of our intelligence reach, know everything that we need to know, and those relationships are really our force multiplier. I would hate to see those relationships endangered, and I'm worried they have been.
Do you believe Donald Trump is capable of being president?
Well, I think what we're seeing in the early days of this administration is something I've always said, which is people believe they can kind of come into government with judgment or success in other areas, and it's not like being an electrician or a businesswoman. There's no real skill involved. It's more about judgment. After 16 years of being a local elected official, like, I know that I got better each year, and I'll hopefully be better next year, that it is a craft, it is a profession. You need to understand and listen. Things like the Constitution, Congress, and the courts matter. And you can't just come in like a CEO of a company and say, I'm in charge, and this is where we're going. So I hope that the administration can kind of hear what the courts are saying, hear what the American people are saying, hear what people in Congress are saying, that we are all in this together and the power is shared. You might be at the top, but the power really comes from the bottom. And as long as we can keep reminding the White House and the president of that, I think we will continue to win these fights. But these fights are keeping us, distracting us from the work that is urgent of, you know, addressing that economic insecurity that people have, people need to have addressed, that we're doing something to address in L.A. And that's what leadership, I believe, is all about, actually listening and then translating what you hear into action rather than just political rhetoric.
Well, the party is looking for a leader who can take on the sitting president in the next election, and that leader so far hasn't come forward. Who do you think that should be?
I think we've got an amazing, you know, bench of people, friends of mine who I have seen lead, from Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who heads the minority leader in the House there, Mitch Landrieu, who's mayor of New Orleans, you know, governors and senators, people like Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, folks who, you know, really do, I think, lead in a bold and brave way. It's not going to be that we need somebody who's built his or her resume up. I think those rules are kind of off. The last two presidential elections have shown Americans are willing to go into uncharted territory, sometimes for better or sometimes for worse. But we should really focus less on just the ideal candidate and really focus on what we're saying. And I think that person will emerge that will speak to America's fears, but more importantly, to their hopes again. Because, you know, if people think the future doesn't have them in it, this is going to be something that the right can prey on, I think, for a long time.
Well, I understand you met with Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao yesterday and asked for $1 billion in federal money for the Purple Line. What was her response?
She's great. She's actually a very experienced Washington insider who's been a cabinet secretary before and worked in the Department of Transportation. And we just asked for the model that's working. We said L.A. doesn't come to Washington with an empty hat in hand saying, hey, fund all of our expensive infrastructure. We say we've already stepped up with that hat half filled, and we just want you to top it off with our federal tax dollars. L.A. contributes those dollars. We want to bring them back and accelerate jobs, transportation. So it was a very positive meeting, and I'm optimistic that we can get that last segment. This is the one from Century City to UCLA and the VA, done 10 years earlier than we had initially planned.
So you do think that you'll get the money from Washington?
There's money right there. We've heard nothing but positive responses so far. We've brought $3.5 billion back over the last 3.5 years, and that included from Republicans who controlled those dollars on Capitol Hill. So we've shown this is kind of nonpartisan, bipartisan, good for America. To invest in L.A. is to invest in this country, not just in our city, especially in places like our port and airport, which are so important for the entire nation's commerce, not just for L.A.
But meanwhile, Senator Dianne Feinstein is angry that the White House has held up money for Caltrain, to modernize Caltrain, to go from diesel to electric. And she is basically saying she's not going to vote for any of the White House's nominees to the Transportation Department until that money is freed up. A, does that worry you when it comes to getting money for the Purple Line, that that money could be politicized and held up? And B, do you think that Senator Feinstein is making the right move?
Well, absolutely. I think you do need to stand up for those values, and we shouldn't let any of those funds, whether it's affordable housing dollars, community development block grants, greenfield or brownfield money, which turns polluted pieces of land into greenfields. Absolutely, we need to stand up for those things. The good thing about the Purple Line money, it's already been appropriated to the New Starts Fund, which we've drawn from to do everything from the downtown connector, which is linking all of our lines downtown together, north, south, east, west, and the other phases of the Purple Line. So this doesn't require that same level of new funding in a budget. We're just trying to say the existing funding that's there, we got a project ready to go, and if this administration is all about jobs and infrastructure, let us show you the way and help the Olympic bid at the same time.
Speaking of the Olympic bid, L.A. is in a contest with Paris for the 2024 Olympics and perhaps the 2028 Olympics. So if one city doesn't get the 2024 Olympics, the other city might get the 2028 Olympics. Would you accept 2028?
Well, the rules right now are just 2024. We think we've got the best bid, not just for 2024, but in modern Olympic history, one that can turn a profit again, invest that money into health and to kids and youth and sports in Los Angeles. But if they change those rules, and it looks like they may in July, we have had a conversation, as Paris has, of what would make 28 just as good or even better than 2024. And I think that for Paris or for LA, I mean, I've joked that my friends in Paris, I'd love to visit them in 2028. But if it goes the other way around, I think either city that goes second needs to have the resources to really build a strong health campaign, sports infrastructure. My dream, simply put, is to allow kids to play sports for free and have universal access, because too many working families say the son can play and the daughter winds up not being able to play sports, or their kids can only play one sport because it's all they can afford with the uniforms. So if they actually had a partnership with us for an investment that would help all of my people out in Los Angeles even sooner, I think we'd be open to it. But those rules haven't changed, and we're expecting and still gunning for 2024 right now.
Mayor Eric Garcetti, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're starting a new series about LA artists. We're calling it Blank Slate. And few artists are as essential to Los Angeles and its art world as Catherine Opie. Last year, Opie's photographs were shown at LACMA, MoCA, and The Hammer. So it seems fitting that her friends call her the mayor of Los Angeles. She's photographed freeway overpasses, homes in Beverly Hills, surfers, mini malls, and the lesbian leather scene. Opie's work seems to always be one step ahead of the public discourse on gender, identity, and body politics. And Catherine Opie joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm a big KCRW fan, so
well,
it's fantastic.
I'm so happy to have you. Did that intro do you justice?
Yeah, you know. Sure.
Sure, why not?
Why not?
Mayor of Los Angeles, I'll take it.
I know. I mean, I like the mayor. I like our mayor a lot, so it's okay if
you can be co-mayors.
I could be co-mayors. Well, you know, when you walk in through the airport and you have the mayor greeting you in the city.
That should be you.
Well, no, I actually made all those photographs for the mayor.
You did?
Yeah. I said, well, listen, the one thing that I need to change if you're elected mayor is the way that we greet the public at LAX. I said, it's horrible. All the mayors are standing there in suit and tie with flags on either side. And what does that really say? I said, let's make something that talks about Los Angeles as a place, about where you can go, the kind of cultural expansiveness of this city. And so I proposed this to him, and he got elected. And then we went about together making the series of photographs that hang at the airport that greet the visitors of Los Angeles.
So let's talk then about how you view Los Angeles, since we're talking about the mayor and Los Angeles. And a lot of your photographs, well, the freeway overpasses seem to capture Los Angeles, the surfers as well. How do you see the city?
I think, you know, it was interesting because I moved down here in 86 from San Francisco. And all my friends in San Francisco were like, oh, you're moving to L.A.? Like, no, you'll be back. You'll do grad program for 2 years and then you're going to be back. And I was like, no, I'm not coming back home. L.A. is too interesting.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. You started taking pictures when you were really young, 9 years old. You had a camera and took a self-portrait, which you have in this book I have in front of me, Catherine Opie, American Photographer. And I wonder if you could describe this photo. You look much like you do right now.
I do. Some things don't really change. I still wear glasses. And I'm making muscles in a very funny flowered pants where the zipper is halfway down. And my bangs are cut very kind of crooked because my mom gave me all my haircuts at that time. It looks like I took scissors to it. But yeah, now I look at it and I'm like, ah, that's me at 9. Full of spunk still.
Full of self-confidence. Okay, so then let's move to some other self-portraits that you took.
Yeah, the self-portraits were in some ways what ended up launching me in the larger art world. I made self-portrait cutting on my back, and it's of two stick figure girls with skirts, often what a kindergarten would draw of their family.
Little house with a smokestack.
Little house, smokestack. And then because we're dealing with issues in 1993, still in the AIDS epidemic, actually, the kind of polarizing politics of the time, and realizing that this image spoke in really many different ways, and then to literally have it cut in your skin so that the blood begins to be part of the discourse was a way for me to begin to really deal with larger issues of homophobia and what it is to kind of be in our bodies and to be identified as queer beings.
Who did this on your back?
It was a really amazing artist here in Los Angeles by the name of Judy Bamber. And she wasn't part of the larger leather community that I was a part of. And I had her practice on chicken breasts in the kitchen before she did it. And every time she would make a mark, her hand would shake. My friends kept having to calm her down that she was doing okay and it was okay that, you know, this was consensual and I'm asking her to help me make this piece. And then I did the more daring piece, which is you're looking at on the next page, which was in 1994. And that was having an amazing body modifier by the name of Raylan Galena, who has since passed away from breast cancer. But she did the incredible cutting of pervert on my chest.
And it's red from the blood. It says yeah. Pervert. And it's across your entire chest. It's yeah. Not a small word.
No, it's huge. So this, the first time that this image showed was actually in the 1995 Whitney Biennial. And so I had to go home to my parents in Poway, California with a little 11x14 print and tell them that this was going to show in a major American art museum and that I needed to come home and show it to them before all of a sudden it went out into the public. And that was a very interesting conversation.
How did that go down?
It went down okay. My parents were divorced, but my mom had a much harder time with it. And then my father was proud of his daughter being in a major museum.
What did he think, though, of the image?
I think that he probably didn't like it, but he liked that I took the chance to make such an outrageous image.
Hmm.
So he had appreciated my adventures as a daughter.
The next page is you 10 years later breastfeeding.
Yeah, Oliver.
Your baby. And the pervert is faded.
Yeah, it's a scar. It'll be there forever, which I'm completely fine with. And I, you know, when I had Oliver, it was always so important for me to have a child. It was one of my goals. You know, since I was young, I would go around saying, I'm going to have 12 children. And of course, then when you're a lesbian, it's a little bit harder to think about the idea of making family. And that's also what the first self-portrait is about, this longing of family and of domesticity and whether or not it was really truly obtainable in my lifetime in terms of being an activist and being an out queer, as well as getting a teaching job like at UCLA and all of these things. I mean, the first thing when I made those earlier self-portraits was I was like, well, that's that. I'm not ever going to be able to get a teaching job anywhere. And of course, that turned out not to be true. So I think you have to make the art that you want to make and kind of face your fears in different ways. And censorship and self-censorship is a really interesting thing to kind of go up against. You know, a lot of the new work that I'm doing now is about longing and ideas of past and present and so forth, utopic, dystopic. These are themes that go through all of my work. I mean, you can think of empty freeways as monuments that are slightly dystopic, but they're also about form and kind of the beauty of the form. Mm-hmm. So these are the themes.
And the longing to go somewhere.
Yeah, and the longing to go somewhere. So these are like the long kind of ways that I stretch through various bodies of work in the same way that surfers hover in the ocean just waiting. That's also a sense of longing to a certain extent. So the cutting on my back wasn't necessarily saying, oh God, I'm never going to have this. It was about acknowledging that it was part of my body and part of my life's goal and part of the very essence of who I am as a person, mm-hmm. that I really wanted a domestic relationship and a family and so forth. And I've been able to have that now for the last 16 years. So it's pretty amazing.
Your later work does show very, almost normal pictures of domesticity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no leather, there's no cutting, there's no piercings. Maybe they're lesbian couples. Aside from that, they're conventional.
Yeah, but I would say that there's an edge, even in the body of work domestic, where I bought an RV and I traveled around the United States for 3.5 months photographing with an 8x10 camera lesbian couples. There's also lesbian households within that. So that the convention of the idea of a heteronormative aspect of living isn't completely reflected within the body of work, because households and communities also create family.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your work, this other book I have here, and it is entirely photographs from Elizabeth Taylor's home.
Yeah.
So just to describe for people who obviously can't see right now, we're talking about pictures of her possessions, her clothes.
Her closets. Her jewelry,
shoes.
Her bookshelves, her bedside table.
And she's not in this. She's not a picture of her in this book. Did she not want her picture taken?
You know, people have asked me this in different interviews. They're like, well, why didn't you want to do a portrait of Elizabeth Taylor? And I was like, well, I was making a portrait of her.
Mm-hmm.
I find it a much more intimate portrait through this body of work than having her sit for me for 40 minutes, me looking at her. And I love making portraits. I make a lot of them. But somebody who's as iconic of a movie star and who has been photographed as much as Elizabeth Taylor, what would it really mean for Kathy Opie to take her photograph? I don't know if it would mean that much to her or to myself, because somebody as iconic as Elizabeth Taylor as well, you could have really fluffed it up in a certain way. I don't think I've ever used that word before, fluffed it up.
I guess, was before you did this project, was she a hero of yours?
She was a very much a person that I think my mother really looked up to. And we would just talk about her all the time. And National Velvet, I must have seen before I was even 13 years old, I must have seen it over a dozen times.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that I liked her boldness. And in a certain way, my activism came out of my sexuality in terms of identifying at a very young age, almost clear in the 9-year-old portrait that I was going to grow up to be a little baby dyke. So,
but I wonder if watching National Velvet, like there's something there that you saw, maybe not consciously, but there's something there that you saw in her.
She's tough.
That you could say, yeah, I relate to this woman.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. But it's also like the idea of glamour and, you know, even her dressing table where all the makeup is, that's so far away from my own reality, you know. And I would look at it like there's one picture where it's like this beautiful little line of tweezers in a silver cup. And it's like, I think maybe I have one pair of tweezers. And it's like, well, what would you use 7 tweezers for? So the idea of her femininity was really, really fun for me to kind of look at. And what does it mean to be that kind of real femme fatale to a certain extent?
So you're now working on a project that is reimagining La Jetée.
It is.
The French,
yes,
film from the 60s that imagines World War III.
From 1962, yeah. Reimagines World War III. If in 1962 we feared the end of the world because of nuclear proliferation and the fear now, and especially in Los Angeles as it's becoming more unaffordable to live here, is the fear of never being able to obtain what we really love, which is modernist houses, right?
That's really funny.
I'll never have a Truesdale estate house. I just won't. I'll never be able to have the Chemisphere or the Sheets Goldstein house or any of these houses that I really, really love. No, and I'm okay with that. So this will be the show at Regan Projects in January.
I can't wait. I can't wait to see that.
Oh, I can't wait either.
You're like,
just crossing my fingers that it's going to be okay.
I have to ask you about your alter ego.
Bo?
Yes.
Oh, you're going to ask me about Bo.
Why Bo? Who's Bo?
Well, okay.
And it's B-O, not B-E-A-U.
It's B-O. It is. It's not B-E-A-U like a boyfriend or Bo, like the Southern Bo. Okay, true fact. I've watched Days of Our Lives since I was 7 years old. If I were to pick any dude that I would have wanted to be from Days of Our Lives, it would have been Bo. He always had a beard and scruffy hair, and he like rode a motorcycle, and he was kind of badass, and it's true.
What happened to Bo?
It's guilty pleasure. He died.
Oh, no.
And he's really dead. You know, people come back from the dead all the time.
Right.
But my Bo died a long time ago because I lost the mustache. It was really funny because I was dating a woman at that time period, and I think that she was actually a little bit more in love with my alter ego, Bo, than she was me. And so one day, like, I literally lost the mustache, and I had had that mustache for, I don't know, 6-7 years, a really long time. And she goes like, well, can I be with Bo tonight? And I was like, no, Bo's dead. And she goes, what do you mean Bo's dead? And I'm like, well, I lost the mustache. Well, can't you get a different mustache? I'm like, no, that was the mustache. Bo's gone. He's dead. I'm sorry. We broke up shortly after.
Well, Catherine Opie, thank you for coming in today. It's been really fun.
Well, thank you very much.
Catherine Opie is a photographer and artist based here in Los Angeles. She's the first in our new series on LA artists. You can find that and see Opie's photographs, including her portrait of Bo, at kcrw.com/blankslate. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Stuck in traffic, bummed out, bored. We've all been there. But occasionally you look around and see a car that just makes you smile. Chrome and shine and maybe some airbrush work, some hydraulics. Catching sight of a lowrider is one of those treats that makes driving in LA a little more bearable. But as much as you may like that ride, it means a lot more to the guys who design them.
Do you think that's just a car?
Do you know how much heart and soul went into that car, Daniel? That is your heritage. It's priceless. This is a work of art. Something you know nothing about.
You know what? I guarantee you, I'm gonna make it with my art.
Just like your brother, you both are hopeless.
That's Damien Bashir and Gabriel Echevarria playing father and son in the new movie Lowriders. Daniel Alvarez is the son. He's a young graffiti artist whose dad wants him to join the family business instead, which is designing custom lowriders. Daniel also wants to bond again with his brother, Francisco, who's just out of prison. Dad, not on good terms with Francisco. It's a story about family, tradition, and a culture that began in East LA in the 1950s. It's a large part of Chicano life. Lowriders director Ricardo de Montroy is here with us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You were born in Peru. You studied painting there as a kid.
Yes.
And so do you see yourself in your lead character?
Somehow. I mean, I guess any artist has a dream to get an audience. Sometimes, I mean, could be just as crossing as short the journey as crossing a bridge,
mm-hmm.
or as long as coming from Peru to Los Angeles. Right?
What did you know about lowrider culture?
I knew about lowriding culture from music videos. I used to work for MTV for many years in Miami, so I was very familiar with the cars. But yes, from a kid's point of view, When I moved to LA 12 years ago, I started hanging out a lot in Boyle Heights downtown and started learning about the real meaning of lowriders, where they come from, and what the media haven't shown about lowriding, which is like tradition, culture, and family.
Yeah.
You know?
So you just on your own, you began talking to the guys who make these cars and started meeting people in the culture.
When I moved here, I moved because NBC hired me to run Mundos, a young channel, doesn't exist anymore, for young Latinos in English. So, I mean, I really wanted to submerge myself into mm-hmm. the culture. I'm impressed and amazed by how vibrant and exciting and rich the cultural scene in East LA is today, and it was like 12 years ago when I arrived, and since then it just gotten more exciting and diverse and always heavily influenced by Mexican-American culture. I was asking myself, why is Hollywood not telling stories about this, right? Why always same stories about Beverly Hills, Malibu, and about people that nobody can relate because nobody can live those lives. And so when Brian Grazer and Kim Roth, who are the producers of the film, like from Imagine, they offered me to make that film. I was like, wow, you know, over the moon. I was like, yes, let's make this. It's going to be a unique opportunity to tell a story from about this subculture.
So how much research did you have to do? How much actual living in that culture did you do?
I already had a lot of research, basically from Mundos already. You know,
so
and
you already knew a lot
because
about it.
Also I was working, I mean, I came here and I, what's the word, recruit, hires a lot of artists, young artists from that was coming from the east side of the city, you know, and the more I worked with them, the more fascinated with the culture I became, the more passionate about it.
Describe the culture, because you depict it as a culture that is very much bound in family.
Yes.
And that these, I guess these families and the people that work with the families all kind of form around creating these cars, building these cars, and
yes.
creating the
I mean,
culture.
Low riding, I mean, even though, I mean, it's a unique art form, and each artist and family, you know, expresses themselves through these cars, and they evolve through the generations, you know. I mean, some of these cars take like 10, 15, 20 years to be built.
Really?
Well, I mean, it's like any piece of art, it's never finished, right? It's insane the level of detail that they put on those cars. You know, every screw is engraved and chromed. Then there's like hoppers, which are like a different. So there are many kinds of lowriders within the lowrider world, right? Hoppers are the ones that really that hop.
Those are the ones with the hydraulics that go up and down.
Yeah, like that's super high, right? Yeah, those ones get like damaged, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And they have to be rebuilt after a few hops, you know? Lowrider owners start using hydraulics to lift the cars when they were driving in front of police. The police passed and then the car dropped again.
Yeah. And where did the whole idea of a lowrider come from? Like where why is that important that the car ride low?
The tradition of lowriding comes from Mexico, from Sundays. You know, men would, instead of cruising, they would walk around the plaza, you know, looking for the girls, you know. That's how lowriding started. You know, it was just the idea of going out on Sunday and cruise around town.
And so that was sort of seen as undesirable or a criminal element by the police here?
Because it was different, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it was like self-expression, so they didn't want them to be able to express themselves, I guess.
Okay, so in your movie, Daniel the Son, he's an artist, and he, I guess he designs a hood design for his brother's car.
Yes.
So how important is that kind of the unique element of the actual painting, the drawing on the hood of the car?
There's a lot of symbolism within those drawings and paintings, and so they're very important, and especially because they are unique.
And is it usually a picture of a woman?
Well, in this case, yeah, it was Danny, who is the kid from whom we see the film. And he's a kid from East LA, but he's not really aware of lowriders or like really what lowriders are about, even though his father builds lowriding, which I think is a very universal story or theme in the sense that most young people reject where they come from. Beautiful irony is that when you grow up, you realize that the most important and valuable thing that you have is that, where you come from. And that's a little bit of Danny's journey in this film.
I want to play a clip of a scene between Daniel and his girlfriend, Lorelai. She's a photographer, and they're talking about art and whether or not what he does is art and what it means.
You think because you got a fancy loft and your fishnets are torn makes you unique? It doesn't. And when you can admit that, then you can start talking to me about my culture.
Well, you're the guy who doesn't want to sell out, right? You'll climb some building and risk your life because your art doesn't need a gallery or a price tag. No, you just need an audience. Well, let me tell you something. Famous graffiti artists are in galleries and on bridges. You don't have to be poor to be real. You do have to put your art somewhere where people can actually tell you what they think about it, not just on some car. Art is a conversation, and yours is a little one-sided because you're so afraid of what people are going to say.
So she's talking about him painting a car and also painting graffiti in places where people can't see it.
It's just what we were talking about. You know, Danny is a kid from East LA that wants to be like Lorelei. And Lorelei, she's a kid from the suburbs that wants to be like Danny. They are like each one running away from who they, from their backgrounds. You know, like Lorelei wants to be cool. I don't know, she wants to live in downtown and be around graffiti artists and lowriders. And Danny wants to be like a cool graffiti artist, but that has no identity. His art is just like a very generic at the beginning of the film. It has no voice because he's ignoring where he comes from, or at least the art that he puts out there, not the one that he's hiding.
And in your particular case with your movie, what are you trying to convey?
I really wanted to, I don't know, let Americans know that they have this amazing art form, which are lowriders that are part of, that were born in California. It's a form of art that the world admires. You know, they're extremely popular in Japan, in Brazil, in France, in Italy. And a lot of people don't know that they are part of the American cultural fabric, just like rock or jazz or, you know. So people deserve to know.
Is that because they're associated here sometimes with gang culture and violence?
That's the irony, because they get pressed only when bad things happen.
Yeah.
But they don't know that, like, every year they ship hundreds of those cars to Japan to amazing, events, lowrider events. People invest a lot of money on those cars because they're beautiful. And so that's the irony.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Ricardo de Montreuil. He's the director of Lowriders. You can see it in theaters now.